So hi, Dennis. Thanks for coming in, and really appreciate you taking the time to join us on the Ship Energy podcast this week.
It's a pleasure. Look forward to having a chat about the industry.
That's great. Yeah, well, Dennis and I, we should put this out there. We've known each other for at least a decade, I would think now. Dennis was responsible for hiring me to join Braemar Shipping Services back in 2010, I think it was. And so I enjoyed a very happy some 5 years there before I moved on. And Dennis at Braemar was responsible in particular for Braemar Tankers and for growing the brand internationally, particularly in Asia. And that's where all the growth in energy consumption has been for the last 20 years or so. So, you know, based on your experience of that, Dennis, you know, what's your view on how energy transition is how are the Asians in particular going to manage the energy transition out of hydrocarbons?
Well, it's very good, Mark. You were right. 2010, roughly, when we met, you joined, and you know, look how we've moved from then. I mean, there it was. That's 11 years ago, which doesn't seem that long, but it's been an incredible journey in those 11 years. And Asia in particular, you know, has raced ahead. They knew where they were going in their demands for energy, for oil. They knew where they were going in their demands for their own construction. And they made huge purchases of raw materials to suit them. And you know, being a ship broker at the time, and you know, understanding the fact that shipping's center of gravity is slowly shifting from the central west to the central east, and then far east, you know, became fairly logical. So we concentrated on that area, and quite rightly, there was a transition. A lot of people had to understand the culture of dealing in the Far East. It was not an easy one. As an intermediary, which we were in Braemar, we had to understand that culture ourselves and build a bridge between the people. So many of the industry participants have been involved in Asian businesses, from building ships and trading different cargoes out there. But the intensity and the large volumes of business that suddenly came to the market brought not just people, those that were familiar with trading in Asia, but also a whole lot of people that weren't familiar with trading in Asia. So that transition was remarkable. And here we are in 2021, where we're looking at the energy demands of that part of the world in combination with the energy demands of the rest of the world. And even now, we're still confused ourselves as to how much is needed, where it's needed, and when it's needed. And that's something where researchers and analysts, you know, forever looking, and shipping people, you know, want to perform and deliver those cargoes.
Yes, then those cargoes are going to have to change, aren't they? You know, with the energy transition upon us, you'll have seen the news, same as everyone else, about the Dutch court telling Shell this week it has to decarbonize by 45% by 2030. I suppose the Netherlands has a particular interest, being so low-lying. It has more to lose than most countries from any potential rises in sea levels. But, you know, we're moving to a multi-fuel world, and you've seen that through your career, and that's going to change as we move out of hydrocarbons. And you're now bringing your four decades plus of experience to the Baltic Exchange as chairman of the Baltic Exchange Council there. So how do organizations like the Baltic Exchange adjust their operations to a multi-fuel world as you're producing and marketing indices and so on?
I mean, it's important that the Baltic has to stay abreast of all the changes. And, you know, as the world moves, there are demands on different quantities of product, whether it's a fuel oil or whether it's a cargo amount, whatever there is, it's a quantum. And in the market, there are many people that trade the differences in prices on those quantums. And the Baltic creates indices which people can use as benchmarks to trade the differences in prices. And so as time's moved on, the Baltic is an institution that has concentrated on getting that toolbox efficient and workable. And sometimes we don't know what the next trading group wants. So we will build something that might suit a trade, but we won't be able to fine-tune it until that trade takes place. And you used a very good example of the bunkers. Of course, the Baltic has been familiar with the type of bunkers used on ships over the years. They have a huge membership who are, a lot of them represent owners and the shipping the shipping fraternity. So they're fully aware and fully experienced. But as that moves and as those ship owners talk to the Baltic members and the Baltic themselves, the Baltic starts to build its own intelligence where it can develop a new index to suit potentially new bunkers, for example. Like we develop a new index to actually introduce new cargoes, such as LNG and LPG, which have been done within the last 10 years, of course.
Yeah, the new fuels is interesting. The Baltic adjusts the standard ship size and type, doesn't it? And will adjust the consumptions when it's generating a rate for a route, for instance. So I suppose if and when new fuels become available, the Baltic will have to try and adjust the indices again to take account of, for instance, VLCCs burning LNG.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Baltic can't build futuristic models. It could envisage what might be coming, but it can't actually build those because for it to model its indices, it has to use data, and data must be available. So they can only take what is fundamentally the average ship within a class or its average consumption. Or you could look at the future and say, okay, in the next 5 years, ships being built with this speed profile, this speed curve, a consumption curve. So you can model what is coming because you know where the average is leaning towards. But to get futuristic and start building models that involve the consumption of hydrogen or ammonia is something which the Baltic would have the capability of doing when it happens, but to build futuristically is something which the Baltic isn't going to do just like that.
That change in the fuel thing is, it's going to change tanker, you're a tanker markets expert and great experience in that market, and the change in the fuel is going to change the oil markets and the tanker markets in particular, isn't it? There's an outfit called Carbon Tracker, and they say that 45% of the global market cap has to decarbonize by 2050. So they suggest that therefore hydrocarbon demand has to fall. The CONCARWE, which is the European Association of Refiners, came onto our podcast in January this year and said that oil transport demand is going to fall now by between 1-3% a year. So I guess the tanker owners and the freight markets and the people who report them, like the Baltic, are going to have to adjust to those new cargoes and new trades.
It's true what you said in that. I mean, there's two sides to this conversation. I mean, obviously the fuels that ships burn, and that's not unique to tankers, bulkers and container vessels, cruise liners, even inland waterway barges and stuff. So that's one side of it, what they burn, and that's what they emit. And then the other side of it is the energy itself and how the world is going to transition itself from what is fundamentally a dirty energy into something very clean. What the world has to consider is that transition has to include countries that have developed and also has to include countries that are developing. And developing countries don't have many options at the moment to suddenly develop energy cells from solar or wind, particularly if they're not in a windy area or they're not in a sunny disposition. So they have to turn to energy that is available to them. Of course, those developed countries that do have a sunny disposition or have a good wind or tidal power at their fingertips, can actually put the money into the research and development areas to grow that. The developing countries aren't going to be in the mood to support the developed countries' research. The developing countries are in the mood to build their own energy backdrop. And so when you come to shipping about how much shipping will drop over the next 5 years, it is true to make statements from countries that are developed to developed countries, but it's probably less true from the underdeveloped world. And cargoes will move in that direction, countering the balance of the developed requirement. And it's important to understand that transition. And some of the commentators in the market who quite rightly say if the world doesn't come into a net zero position by 2050, our world will degrade and deteriorate, are saying the right things. But to get that mindset across to the globe, and that's everybody, not the developed countries alone, it may take a bit longer than 2050.
Yeah, President Xi has come out with 2060 as a date, hasn't he? And the IEA has famously said in the last fortnight that if the world is to decarbonize, get to net zero emissions by 2050, then we have to stop investing in hydrocarbons now, this year.
Which, of course, can't happen because, you know, we've accustomed ourselves to using plastics. Everything in our home has got plastic relationship to it, whether it's from a TV set to a handheld telephone, or whether it's the paint on the wall, or whether it's part of your kitchen equipment. You know, everything has got plastics, and you've got even your own car, whether you put fuel in it to run it or whether you have battery in it, it's full of plastic. So these are things that we're not going to get away from the hydrocarbons because they're absolutely required. The question is how can we use them carefully? And what we can't do, and that's the one thing, Mark, which I do want to say, is that we can't wash it away. If a country stands up and says, we are going to be carbon neutral by 2030, and the neighbouring country says, we're going to be carbon neutral by 2040, you know, the border between the two countries isn't going to recognise the 10 years difference. And so while one country tries desperately to reduce its footprint in every which way, its neighbouring countries around have a different profile as when they want to become net zero or trying to get to net zero. And that disturbs, of course, the average across the whole world. And that's really what we're looking at here.
Yeah, that global average. It's one of the reasons, I suppose, why there has to be a global response. And if we think about shipping in particular, there's been a lot of talk about having a global regime of a carbon levy on marine fuels, for instance, which the charterers would pick up. It would be passed on in the freight rate to the charterers. And the European Union has decided to delay until July its view on including shipping in the European emission trading scheme. But, you know, it's being flagged that shipping will come under that from next year. So one of the conversations that we've had in the recent past, and I think might interest our listeners, is this idea of how cargo owners can assist ship owners to, is there this idea of a sweet spot? Perhaps you could explain that to us. So I think it's the idea is that there's a sweet spot at which a cargo owner can bear responsibility for the emissions of a ship as it's moving their cargo and their costs, the cost of the emissions, whilst assisting the owners to sail with the due dispatch that that is included in every charter party.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think sweet spot is perfect. I mean, the responsibility of the emissions comes on the owners of the cargo as well as the owners of the ships and, of course, the consumers. So everyone has actually got an interest in the cargo on board a ship for different reasons. And the responsibility for the cost of transporting that falls across all three categories, with the consumer naturally being the final user of the cargo in its you know, refined and its produced form. The supplier, of course, wants to sell it, but the cargo owner in the middle, he also has a responsibility of ensuring that the emissions from his mode of transport isn't damaging the world. If he chooses to find a vessel that is a high emitting vessel, he needs to contribute to that high emission on that vessel some way or another. If he chooses to find a ship that is a low emitting vessel, then his contribution has to be to the fact that the consumer is receiving a lower emission cargo. But of course, he will charge that consumer for the cost of finding that lower emitting vessel. So the word sweet spot means there is a point, and not every ship is different. That would be unfair because there's many sister ships with similarities. In fact, to most laymen, every ship looks identical. But in fact, you know, the classes of ships and types of ships, each one will have a sweet spot where the cargo owner and the ship owner have to agree as to how that ship can be traded. It could well be in speed. And we all know that if we slow down, the emissions do decrease quite dramatically. Also, you burn less fuel, yes, over a longer period, but the actual carbon CO2s are much reduced. And that slow speed, of course, brings a lot of other questions in. How long the cargo takes to get from A to B, how impatient the consumer is to receive it. You know, in-time cargo is a very important part of the logistic. If you speed a ship up, is that the owner's responsibility for the emissions, or is it the cargo owner's responsibility to pay for the extra commissions because he wants a quicker cargo? And there's a sweet spot in there which has to be traded. And going back to the Baltic, the indices that can be produced can actually find that, shall we call, sweet spot, and mm-hmm. you trade above it or below it and pay for your utilization.
So a little bit like at the moment where, the time charter rate on a VLCC today is probably, what, $28,000, $30,000 a day, something like that?
If you wanted a time charter of vessel, however, the time charter equivalent of that very same vessel is way under half of that number.
Exactly. That's the point I was going to make. If you look at the Baltic Index for VLCCs, for TD1, say, if it's still there, it's probably a negative number today. But it's not the case that the ship owner is paying the cargo owner to move his cargo. But the differential can be on the bunkers, can't they, by proceeding with due dispatch but getting cheaper bunkers than is included in the freight rate, or by sailing more slowly but still achieving the laycan.
Well, that's right. So the pressure is on the ship owner to reduce his emissions. He will say to the charterer, if I have to reduce my emission, I have to go slow, or I have to burn a fuel that is less emissive, or I have to scrub my fuel and then dispose of what I've scrubbed, whether it's open loop or closed loop, into the sea or not. And that, of course, upsets consumers, because the thought of carbon going into the sea and being dispersed isn't very appealing to people. Keeping it on board the ship, it's toxic, it's dangerous, and then it's got to be disposed of somewhere, somehow. So these are complex thought processes. But if a charterer says, no, I want the ship to go fast, then he has to pay for that speed, not only in the cost of the bunkers, but also in the cost of emissions.
Yeah. So I think that the ETS will take account of that by charging on the carbon dioxide emissions from the ship. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how that will be modelled in. That's how it can be modelled in.
I think what surprises me about the sweet spot conversation is I think there's a general assumption that it means that everyone will either switch to low carbon fuels or ships will sail more slowly. But your point is valid, isn't it? That some cargo owners, some charterers will say, no, I do want you to sail at 12 and a half, 13, 14 knots and arrive at that date. And I'll pay the emission on that because I need the cargo there at that date.
It's a very good question on that one as well, or a very good statement. I think about container vessels that will go across huge ocean at 18 to 20 knots and then wait 2 weeks. There is no fine. There is a demurrage, of course. There is no fine to that cargo line racing across the Pacific or the Atlantic and then causing all those emissions and then sitting a ship for 2 weeks of discharge. That owner of those boxes on top of that ship, it's just free storage, if you like. But actually, to the world, that's a strong amount of emission and a lot of wastage waiting. That's got to be calculated for, and someone should pay for that. And I don't think it should be the ship owner.
Yeah, I think I think BIMCO and some other associations, including the MEPC at the IMO, have been working on charter clauses that will allow that Russian weight model to be replaced. But it involves a lot more communication than has traditionally been the case between charterers and operators of vessels. And we had a guest on the podcast recently who said, that this might alter the way that the shipping industry works, because it has tended to work on an almost adversarial negotiation. I know this information, you don't, and therefore I can squeeze the freight rate either up or down for you. Whereas there's going to have to be a lot more openness in the future if we're going to avoid that Russian weight model and reduce those emissions from that type of shipment that you described just before.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Mark. I mean, there's no question. We can't. I mean, rushing and waiting it sounds plausible, but the one thing we need to get into some context. I mean, shipping, it is becoming fairly well stated that it's responsible for about 2.8 or 3% of world emissions. I mean, the biggest emission issue at the moment is in heating, and I use the word heating and cooling. So the world heats and cools its living spaces as the human race wants it, as it's preferred, as it enjoys, and this is an enormous cost to the global emission and the global footprint of carbon. Shipping is much, much smaller. And I think a lot of very smart people, engineers, people that operate ships, people that understand energy cargoes are putting a lot of effort into trying to find a way where shipping can reduce its footprint. But as the world carbon footprint goes down, the percentage that is attributed to shipping is still going to be approximately the same. It's just going to be of a far lesser amount, we hope. I don't want to cast aspersions to the aviation industry, but there's going to be a lot of engineering that has to happen before the aviation industry can reduce its carbon footprint with any significance. And the automotive industry has proved that it can, because a lot of money has been put into that. The automotive industry, of course, is a direct service to the consumer. And the consumer sees and feels the automotive industry immediately. Whilst when it comes in shipping, it's a part that hasn't actually happened yet. And remember, everything that comes by ship, or sorry, everything in a car in the automotive industry, most of the parts have actually arrived by ship.
And the car itself, in many cases.
The car, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, that heating and cooling issue is, you know, we might get around some of the increased demand for heating and cooling by having a new invention known as the openable window. I can remember being in Tokyo one very hot summer when officers were requested to turn their air conditioning to 28 degrees. And if the temperature went above 28 degrees, gentlemen were allowed to remove their ties. So perhaps we just all need to be a little bit more stoical.
Yes, and again, people aren't like that, Mark, are they? They want their comfort, creature comforts, and each human is different. So some people can enjoy 28 degrees, particularly if you've been in the UK for the last month, you lap that up. But there's others that would find 28 degrees if the humidity was at 95%, it's just a little bit too much to bear.
Bit different in Singapore, isn't it? Yes, unless you're down on Boat Quay with a cold drink. So. There's one more thing I wanted to talk to you about today, Dennis, and that is one of the things that will happen, I think, with the energy transition is that ship owners are going to struggle to raise the capital to build ships with new and expensive forms of propulsion, whether it's LNG or ammonia or hydrogen or hybrid engines. And one way to get around that is to have the construction of the ship sponsored by a long-term charter. Because then the financing bank can treat it like project finance and it knows that it's got transparent and pretty well guaranteed forward cash flow from the ship operations. And the credit risk is actually the charterer, which is likely to be a much bigger corporation than the ship owner, which could be a small independent owner, which is great. But one of the things that bothers me about that is what does it do to the spot market? If you have more and more ships being built with alternative engines going on to long-term charter, in a market, particularly, I'm thinking particularly about tankers here, where oil demand may never go back up to more than 100 million barrels a day and might be approaching the point at which we go into long-term decline. What does that do to the spot market over time?
If it actually happens, Mark, and if we actually do have sort of sponsored shipbuilding by the major utilizers of the ships, the major cargoes, if that does actually happen, we will be going back in time to the days when the Seven Sisters used to build ships to suit their trade. They would finance it through a ship owner that knew how to manage, operate, and work a ship. Because remember, the oil companies in those days, you know, they understood the logistics of the cargo, but didn't actually understand the actual working mechanics of the ship. You needed specialists, especially in the days of the turbines. That, of course, continued until there was a drop in the market. And when there was a drop in the market, there was a surplus of ships on charter to oil companies. And when they weren't used, they were basically laid up or idled. And the spot market itself was only needed as and when there was a surplus to requirement of the idled ships. As time went forward, of course, people remembered getting burnt in those markets and decided not to replenish with endless time charters and contracts with freightmans. And they actually used the spot market. So the spot market became their friend, because that spot market could be expensive or cheap, depending on the availability of tonnage at any one time. What it did mean, they didn't have to manage a ship. So if we fast forward that to what might happen the next, say, 10 years whilst we're transitioning, or whilst we believe we're transitioning, whether it's not actually in fuel itself, but just transitioning in our energy demands of the world. If there are cargo owners that actually want to guarantee their transportation at a price which they can manage the emission and manage the cost of the energy burned and manage the commodity on board it, they will end up building and acquiring the fleet required, and the spot market will diminish itself and back down to a much smaller percentage. However, when the spot market drops to a smaller percentage of the time charter, significantly smaller, there are opportunities that are very, very grand. And those spot markets can be exceptionally volatile mm-hmm. when let's say the spot market represented 20% of the whole market, exceptionally volatile. If the spot market represented 50% of the whole market, which it does today, then the volatilities just come in, you know, in occasional volatilities when two or three things simultaneously happen that squeezes a market. Mm.
Maybe we've seen that in the large LNG tanker market in the last couple of years.
That's a great example of what happens in the large LNG. When there's an opportunity, the markets spike and big prices are paid. And of course, they need to be, because large LNG ships are exceptionally expensive items.
They're not cheap bits of kit, are they? No. No, if you've got a $200 million ship, you want the occasional $350,000 a day payday, don't you?
So quite a lot of it, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think the energy shipping market is going to be the one that experiences the greatest dizziness during the energy transition. And I think, you know, that means the tanker market. And hopefully today's oil tanker owners will be tomorrow's ammonia and hydrogen tanker owners. You know, I look forward to talking to you one day about the nascent fleet of liquefied hydrogen tankers that are in their spot market in the hydrogen economy. But it's great to be able to share your experience with our listeners, Dennis, and your expertise. So thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, Mark, thank you very much. I enjoy a conversation with you. Let's hope it's we can see the future and do something about it. We definitely want to have a cleaner world all around us, and that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully next time we chat, we'll be able to do it over a clean glass as well. So
thank you, Mark.
Cheers. Thanks very much, Dennis. And thanks to all of you for listening to the Ship Energy Podcast this week. And we'll be back soon.